If there's anything that brings joy to our hearts, it's local boy makes good. And tonight we have a local boy who has certainly made good. He was born in Vancouver in 1940 and spent his time getting a degree here while alternating with various jobs such as gill netting, driving a water taxi, working at BC Sugar, and completing a degree in English and philosophy. He went on to Toronto to get his master's and PhD and has had a very exciting life. I'm afraid I could take up his lecture time if I was just to run through his CV, but I'm sure you'd much rather hear from him than from me. I'll just mention that he taught for 20 years at Concordia. He's written 35 books or arranged them, lectured in 17 countries, and has been translated into 6 languages. So I say, if that isn't a busy life, I don't know what is. So help me welcome Professor Gary Geddes.
I'm waiting to be bodily translated to heaven. I had a job at Western Washington University for a while. I was called Distinguished Professor of Canadian Culture. I told them they'd made a significant error, that it should have been the Extinguished Professor. I'm just getting rid of that portable mic because I think the security of the podium will be useful for me here. In spite of having lectured widely and read poems and talk to audiences forever, I always go through a sort of nervous phase before readings and discussions, and especially when I heard in the introduction that I'm not allowed to read, only to lecture. So probably if that's the case, you'll be out of here in 10 minutes. Writers, I guess, may have an excuse for being allowed to read their works because presumably their most elegant form of communication is on the page. And so as a poet, I'll try to make the reading sound like something better than a textbook reading. I have to tell you though, caveat emptor, buyer beware. I'm a poet, I'm not a scholar. I'm going to make some pretentious statements to begin with, and then I'm going to read some selections from the book that I've brought with me called The Kingdom of 10,000 Things. And then I'd be delighted to answer questions. I probably should make a beeline for the door immediately after I finish the lecture, because I know there are some scholars and scientists here who are going to be nudging one another and having a little chuckle with some of my pronouncements, but we'll have to deal with that. The search for an Asian Marco Polo. When I was a child, playing in the sand at Spanish Banks in English Bay, occasionally I or one of my friends would discover a little glass ball in the water, at times with bits of hemp still attached. This caused a great deal of excitement and made us look with wonder across the waters as if we might glimpse its place of origin. If these bright bubbles of possibility drifted all the way from Japan to the beaches on Vancouver Island and the mainland, why not people, accidentally or by design? It's a good question and one that has interested me increasingly over the years, especially as I grew up in East Vancouver, where the Asian population was quite large, even in the 1950s and 60s. In fact, I went to Britannia High School, and I believe the Chinese and Japanese population was at least 30% in the 50s and 60s. It was quite an amazing school, in fact. In 1974, while I was preparing an anthology of BC writings called Skookum Wawa for publication by Oxford University Press, I came across a small quotation in a book by the popular historian Harold Griffin about an Afghan Buddhist monk named Hui Shen. Griffin called him Hui Shin. The monk, according to the records of the Liang dynasty, had sailed with religious associates from China to the Americas in 458 AD, 1,000 years before Columbus, returning to tell his story to the court historians in 498. I included this amazing tidbit about Hui Hsien in my anthology, and it lay dormant on a shelf in the back of my own mind for 27 years before sitting up, stretching, and demanding attention. Now, this may seem an odd phenomenon to you, but it has become a pattern for me, and I suspect for other writers. I call it the ventriloquism of history. I store something away for God knows what reason, and years later, out of the blue, as it were, or out of the dust, this material suddenly lights up and drifts from the mists of the subconscious into the conscious realm. A hand reaches out from the past and grabs me by the throat, demanding to be heard, wanting to speak through me. Shades of Edgar Bergen with his suitcase full of the monocled and top-hatted dummy Charlie McCarthy. The problem is, I never quite know from one day of writing to the next whether I am the ventriloquist or the ventriloquist dummy. Who is speaking whom? My curiosity about Hui Hsien took me first to two books, Edward Vining's An Inglorious Columbus and Henrietta Mertz's book, Pale Ink, both of them true believers in the story of Hui Hsien. Both of these books take the legend seriously and try to extrapolate on the cryptic account in Hui Hsien's journey to the East, which is only 675 Chinese characters. If you think about how history was passed on in China, you realize that when the new dynasty took over, if they didn't kill the librarian, they put a knife to his throat and said, boil the previous history down to two volumes, the rest of the story is ours. It's a bit like American history, too. As I dug deeper, I was in for a shock. I discovered that a huge body of literature exists on the subject of pre-Columbian Asian contact with the Americas. 5,000 items listed in a single biography, and many more appearing regularly in newspapers and scholarly journals. I also learned that most archaeologists not only dismiss such a possibility completely, but also insist that culture in the Americas developed in total isolation. These are some of the same people who laughed at plate tectonics, of course, and stories about Viking voyages and to the Americas until the evidence was dropped in their laps. Although I found many scholars who strongly support the notion of cultural diffusion and pre-Columbian Asian contact, I met more than one academic who told me that he or she had been warned not to touch this subject with a 10-foot pole for fear of remaining unemployed and never getting a penny of grant money. I'm no scholar, but it seems to me evident, after all that I've been through and read, that pre-Columbian Asian contact is now almost indisputable, especially as pre-Clovis sites are being found in South America that suggest contact possibly 50 to 100,000 years earlier than we had imagined. More sophisticated mitochondrial DNA studies also indicate a more complicated gene pool and a much broader spectrum of origins for Aboriginal peoples in the Americas. Coastal migration seems is most likely the means for peopling the Americas, since ancient peoples had navigational skills and crafts to make such a journey by water. If you doubt this, consider the fact that 8,000-year-old shipbuilding tools have just been found at Eel Point San Clemente in the Channel Islands of California. Columbus was the last to arrive in the Americas, but he had the biggest mouth and the best PR. If there's one thing more stimulating to a poet than curiosity, it's controversy. I could hardly resist placing my big feet where angels and sensible scholars feared to tread. I wanted to see what I could find out about Hui Hsien, who not only preceded Columbus by 1,000 years, but also set out much earlier on a voyage as bold as Marco Polo's, but traveling in the opposite direction. So I decided to retrace Hui Hsien's journey from Kabul over the Silk Road through the Himalayas, the Taklamakan Desert, Buddhist grottos in Turpan, Dunhuang, Luoyang, Datong, across the North Pacific and on the assumption that a monk would seek out the most advanced civilization of the time, down into Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras, the home of the Maya. I arrived in Kabul on a Taliban visa in late August 2001, 2 weeks before planes struck the Twin Towers in New York. What I thought would be a whimsical, irreverent journey in pursuit of an elusive monk and his strange peregrinations turned out, thanks to world events, to be much more complicated, with the Taliban at one end, the Zapatistas at the other, and the turmoil and aftermath of 9/11 coloring everything in the middle. So what I'd like to do now is share with you a few sections from the resulting book, which was called The Kingdom of 10,000 Things, An Impossible Journey from Kabul to Chiapas. I should just say that the title is from a Chinese term for life itself, the Kingdom of 10,000 Things. When I arrived in Kabul, during the short taxi ride to the Taliban's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, my senses were on full alert. I did not know exactly what to expect. Mutilated corpses dangling from lampposts, perhaps. Roving gangs of armed fanatics dressed in black turbans, carrying severed body parts and beating up women not adhering to the strict dress code. These were the images dominating Western media, but they were also reinforced by my interviews with Afghan refugees in Pakistan and from reading reports of opposition groups speaking out against fundamentalist rule. I had in my knapsack postcards of Kabul in its heyday from the 1950s to the 1970s, when it was a thriving modern city, a magnet for young travelers from the West, where they could live cheaply and comfortably and where the drug laws were lax. Theirs was at root a genuine, if misguided and short-circuited spiritual quest, a sort of psychonarcotic equivalent of the great game. The markets were full to bursting, elegant tribal dresses much in demand in the hip boutiques of Vancouver, London, and New York hung in the shop windows, each one a reminder of ancient crafts and current domestic hardship, since Afghan families were not in the habit of selling their heirlooms. In the oddly tinted photographs of the time, now sold as postcards, the city is a fairyland of unnatural pinks and blues, with that forbidding but protective border of mountains in the background. In one postcard, Kabul seems bathed in eternal spring. The moss green of the riverbanks has seeped upward as if by osmosis to stain the houses, pedestrians, even the Shahdol Shamshira Mosque, the mosque of the King of Two Swords, an early Islamic commander who is said to have fought to the death with a sword in each hand, even after he'd lost his head in battle, a sort of precursor of George Bush. In another doctored print, the wintry blue sky has permeated the cloak of snow on surrounding mountains and bled into the capital, giving it a cold, spellbound appearance, offset by a few splashes of ochre. What I now saw bore no resemblance to either the postcards or the media hype. Drought had reduced the river to a trickle. Never properly repaired after the Civil War, the potholed avenues were still wide and generous, but few trees remained and there was little traffic. The fleet of ancient dilapidated taxis, moored and idle, had surrendered the avenues to a smattering of donkey carts, bicycles, relief agency vehicles, and the occasional jeep or SUV driven by a merchant or a Taliban official. Collapsed buildings and mounds of rubble remained as monuments to human folly. But no bodies hung from lampposts, and the only gun I'd seen so far belonged to a bored young Taliban at the airport. Few men in turbans strode purposefully along, but most sat or leaned in the shade, watching the thin parade of vehicles. Dozens of cripples, victims of decades of conflict, bent over crutches. And the one woman I noticed rounding the corner wore a headscarf, not a burqa, and was not accompanied by the requisite male relative. I was surprised by these contradictions. Either the dress code was more relaxed than I'd been led to believe, or the woman was a foreigner, and the absence of guns might owe as much to systematic intimidation as to social stability. I was apprehensive not only from 2 weeks of interviews with Afghan refugees in Pakistan, but also from reading three recent books on the Taliban, in which the long entrenched politics of betrayal, revenge, and ruthless foreign intervention is so strikingly delineated. And I was reminded of the possibility of danger, thanks to the document I'd signed a few hours earlier, absolving the International Red Cross of any responsibility for my safety during and after the flight to Kabul. And this is what the little quotation was. ICRC is taking all possible measures to assure a maximum of security. Nevertheless, it is not possible to guarantee total security. Considering the situation prevailing in the area, anybody is exposed to a certain risk of injuries by bullets, mines, rockets, car bombs, or rubble from ruins, explosions of gas, or water pipes, etc. A comprehensive list, to be sure, with that explosive and ambivalent word, etc., intended to ignite the overly active imagination. At the intersection closest to the Foreign Ministry compound, my taxi refused to give way to a ramshackle handcart containing vegetables and a man with no legs. The relative or friend pulling the cart jumped out of the way, losing his grip on the shafts. Off balance, it careered into the curb, catapulting its passenger and produce onto the sidewalk. The driver grinned at me in the rearview mirror, displaying a mouthful of broken, discolored teeth. As I turned to look out the back window, I caught the eyes of the cripple as he raised himself upright on his hands amid the melons and purple cabbages. His legless torso swung like a pendulum in the mid-morning sun, marking time. Now, my time in Kabul was fairly brief. The Taliban would not give me access to any of the rest of the country. I had wanted to get to Bamiyan, of course, since I was looking for information about a Buddhist monk to see what was left of the Buddhas of Bamiyan and to possibly get into the caves behind the Buddhas. And obviously I didn't tell the Taliban that I was there to do research on Buddhism. I didn't put a scarlet letter B on my forehead for obvious reasons. So I made my way back through Pakistan over the Karakoram Highway through the Himalayas into western China. And this is a little moment where I arrive in China and have the good fortune to meet some other English speakers. In the longing that starts one on the path is a kind of homesickness. Peter Matheson writes in The Snow Leopard, an account of his journey to the infamous monastery at Crystal Mountain deep in the Himalayas. I was thinking of Matheson's work because my New Zealand friend Dave was doing research in Kashgar to see if snow leopard pelts were still showing up in the markets despite the ban on hunting. Like Matheson before him, he found nothing, dead or alive, and had no sightings. Although Matheson never saw a snow leopard, he claimed to have caught a glimpse of his own true nature as he immersed himself in the breadness and the sheepness of his daily routines on the journey. I was prepared for this kind of failure, not finding absolute proof of Hui Shen's travels to the Americas, but I was not quite prepared for the possibility of finding my own true self. The idea seemed preposterous, if not a little unnerving. Especially if you're like me and you're a Gemini. There's at least two true selves there. I knew what he meant, though, about travel as a sign of homesickness. I had arrived in Kashgar in the company of four new acquaintances, all of them writers, who happened to share a bus with me over the Kunjarab Pass from Sost in Pakistan to Tashkurgan in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Regions of China. After weeks of relative silence, I was ecstatic to be swimming in English conversation and experienced a rapid transformation from near-mute stammering to a severe case of motor mouth. Dave and his partner Marika were both writing about environmental issues, had hoped to see varieties of wildlife in Hunza and Kunjarab Pass. Mark Mordew and Lisa Nickel, fiction writers from Sydney, Australia, were stationed in Beijing, where he had a China-Australia scholarship. After we'd gone through the rituals of border crossing, including an officious Chinese soldier who wanted to know what was written in each of my ringed notebooks, we celebrated by having our first Commonwealth feast at a Uyghur restaurant in Tashkirgan. We were so pleased about this unlikely and propitious encounter that we paid little attention to the menu. Assenting to whatever the waiter offered, which included platters of mutton kebabs and delicious vegetable and rice dishes. While we joked and talked shop and belted down large quantities of Chinese beer, my first alcohol in a month, our linguistic and culinary oasis exploded with music. One by one, the Uyghur men rose from their tables to dance, making expressive motions with their hands while the women watched and applauded. While I rejoiced in the English language as one kind of home place, the tainted kebabs were making themselves at home and wreaking havoc in the guts of five foreigners. I was the first to collapse, quite delirious, on the trip northeast to Kashgar the next morning, so weak I almost disappeared into the ground from the weight of my backpack when it was dropped into my arms from the roof of the bus. I made a zigzag course into the hotel lobby, signed something, staggered down a corridor, and collapsed into bed, emerging 36 hours later from an extended bout of fever, hallucinations, liquid bowels, and late-night scrubbing of soiled bedsheets, having experienced yet again the romance of the Silk Road. In my notebook, which I found on the floor beside the bed, a few lines had been scribbled that I had no memory of writing. The script was my own, but it was almost illegible and would take me a while to decipher. I wiped the vomit from the cover and crammed the book into my backpack. Now I'm just going to leap over to a section where I actually have a chance to try to decipher what that scribble was. And this is when a very strange thing happens in the book. I begin to discover that Hui Shan has been sending me messages. And this is where you can tell the reliability disappears and the fantasy enters. The famous Italian Benedetto Croce said, "Without narrative, there is no history." So here we go. As I sat in my room in Dun Huang in the Taklamakan Desert, down the street from Shirley's Cafe, I picked up my notebook to see if I could decipher the chicken tracks I'd scribbled during my hallucinations in Kashgar, breaking the code. Not an easy task, since my handwriting at best and most sober of times is scarcely legible, a fact constantly confirmed over the years by students and family. For postcards I'd taken to write, printing my simple messages, otherwise no one had a clue. To turn the pages properly, I had to twist the loops of spiral wire back into shape as they were continually getting squashed in my backpack. After 20 minutes of fiddling, I realized I had in my possession another tiny chunk of first-person narration. And this is the translation of this material. "I've sat on my ass too long waiting for a change of heart or dynasty to give me access to the learned ones at court, those who might derive instructions from my travel, even pleasure. 4 decades living among strangers have taught me much, but not patience with my own kind. I've not stepped lightly but trod with a heavy foot in mud up to my crotch, been rude and belligerent when what was called for was diplomacy and more than a dose of restraint. It's said a wise man conceals his abilities, crams them like precious jewels up his rectum. I have not been wise or practiced rectitude. What you see are rags, not saffron robes, and what you hear will be offensive to your ears. No tips, no shortcuts to nirvana." So finally, I had a companion, which was very nice. Traveling on your own is difficult at the best of times. But suddenly, my subconscious had thrown up this character, this voice of Hui Shen. And it was very useful. During the time in China when I wasn't communicating with or communing with Hui Shen, I was thinking about previous trips I'd made to China. I'd gone in 1981 with a batch of Canadian writers called the Gang of Seven. Included Alice Munro and Adele Wiseman and several other well-known writers. And we put together a little book after that of memoirs called Chinada, Memoirs of the Gang of Seven. A few years after that, the Chinese writers invited me back, and this time I went with my former wife Jan and three daughters. Bronwyn, aged 9, Charlotte, alias Sarsi, aged 17, and Jenny, 19. We did a round-the-world trip, and part of the most exciting portion of it was in China. So during my time in search of Hui Shen, I was going through these sort of deja vus of times that I'd spent with the family. And this is one of those light moments in the middle of the book when I'm not thinking about the Taliban or anything like that, and not thinking too carefully about my research either. I know somebody's saying back there, we haven't noticed any of that yet. All my trips to China seem to involve problems with shoes. In 1985, when I traveled to Japan and China with my wife, Jan, and three daughters, I did not have proper footwear. I'd resurrected an ancient pair of sandals from the 60s and had them resoled, making them so stiff they would not bend. The noise they made on Tokyo streets and in the subway sounded like rifle shots. After a few days on the road, the straps began to cut into my feet, which with the application of a couple of dozen band-aids were slowly being transformed into abstract works of art. My feet are large, size 12, so big in fact that no store in Tokyo could help me. As it was rare for them to stock even size 9, the diminutive clerks looked at my feet with astonishment and mild horror, as if I were the rough beast slouching towards Ginza to be born. One day, after another fruitless search for shoes, I awakened from a nap at the Kimi Ryokan, a quaint hotel in Tokyo with authentic bamboo mats, sliding doors, and movable partitions in the rooms, thinking I would go for a brief walk. As I descended the stairs, I heard giggling noises in the lobby. Peering around the corner, I saw two attractive teenage girls in the vestibule, one of them standing with her tiny feet in my sandals, which made her look as if she were wearing water skis. The giggles escalated into gales of hysterical laughter. I waited until they'd left to reclaim my scandalized footwear. The search for shoes continued into China, including an entire day cycling around Beijing with my friend Will Gooda, who was teaching English and playing saxophone in a jazz rock band called Beijing Underground. Will had toured the country under the sponsorship of the classical Chinese musicians who ripped him off, playing to huge crowds of enthusiastic young people, but his mission on this day, less exotic and decidedly out of tune, was to locate shoes for Bigfoot. After weaving in and out of bicycle traffic, those vast schools of two-wheeled human fish being swept along the avenues, we hauled up in his apartment at the Yoyi Bingwan Friendship Hotel and consumed several bottles of Qingdao to console ourselves for the failure of our enterprise. My feet, at least, were no worse for wear, thanks to the bicycle. Still, I refused to believe there was no one with my foot size in China. There had to have been a run on big sizes, all those visiting Huns, Mongols, and barbarians cleaning out the stock. When we reached Xi'an, the ancient capital, I went for a walk with the family and our interpreter friends from the Chinese Writers Association. Jan and the three girls were ahead of us checking out bargains at the seaside flea market in progress. I could see their heads, all but 9-year-old Bronwyn's above the crowd, clearly identifying them as kinswomen of Bigfoot. By now, I'd all but given up hope of finding new shoes, but was on the lookout for a repairman to fix the sandal straps, which had broken under the strain of non-compliant soles. To my surprise, among the blankets and plastic tarpaulins covered with debris for sale was a shoemaker's last, a tiny inverted metal foot used as a base for tacking on new soles and heels. Beside the last, miracle of miracles, lay a small assortment of tools. I pointed to my sandals. The shoemaker nodded his head, grinned. I was standing there in my bare feet amid 100 people, each one staring in amusement and disbelief as my sandal balanced on the tiny last and a new strap was attached, when suddenly the crowd parted like the Red Sea, and an attractive young woman in a long white dress with black hair to her waist approached me, pushing a Phoenix bicycle. She stopped in front of the shoemaker's last and gave me a thorough once-over from head to oversized foot. Then, without missing a beat, she said, "Hello." God, she was trying out her English. Far be it from me to ignore a friendly gesture. "Hello. How are you?" "I'm fine," I replied. "Ni hao?" She did not acknowledge my impeccable Chinese or bother to say how she was, which was perfectly obvious, arrestingly beautiful, completely in control. "What is your name?" "My name is Gary." I found myself inadvertently mimicking her clipped pronunciation, giving each syllable identical weight. She did not tell me her name and was not apparently not offended by my unrepentant size 12 feet. She cut right to the quick. "Are you married?" My God, I was being propositioned by Mara, Buddha's constant tempter, a demon disguised as the most beautiful woman in China and half my age. I was not George Washington with his cherry tree and his duty to history. I was a Canadian and quite capable of telling a lie, especially a small innocent one just to prolong the moment. I looked around. I could see Jan's and Jenny's heads farther down the street floating above the stream of shoppers. I thought of my naked and knobbly foot on public display and marveled at its unexpected powers of attraction. How could a barefoot poet enter into such complex and danger-fraught negotiations, which might very easily escalate into an international incident? Only then did I notice that I was balancing on one leg like a chicken, the other foot tucked carefully behind out of sight. "Yes," I clucked, bobbing my head, "I am married." To my surprise, this felt less an admission of defeat, no pun intended, than an acknowledgement of commitment, a safe haven from the hordes of unattached Asian women likely to be smitten by my irresistible feet and the urge to emigrate. Saved again, this time by the Great Wall of Matrimony. "Too bad. Bye-bye." She turned her bicycle around, and with a swish of her long white cotton dress and black rivering hair, moved off from whence she had come, my audience of foot fetishists closing rank behind, as if nothing unusual had happened, as if it had all been a dream. 16 years later, her final words still hung in the air. I could have reached up and plucked them like apples. I'll just read one more short piece, and then we'll talk about, I'd like to open the evening to some discussion about these things. I remember being on a radio program once, and Peter Zosky asked me why I traveled so much and why poets in Canada traveled so much. I said I thought it was for the same reason that bagpipers walked back and forth when they were playing. A moving target was harder to hit. You asked the question why Hui Hsien might have wanted to travel. He was obviously intent on spreading the words of Buddha, but he had also fled persecution in Afghanistan. The white Huns or Hephthalites were doing periodic raids on Afghanistan, trashing the monks and the monasteries. So he fled to China. And in China, the history of Buddhism is not at all a constant rise. Every change of dynasty, there was a potential for one group or the other being in ascendance. And so there might have been a clear sense in Hui Hsien's mind that he'd be safer off in a foreign country. So somehow or other, he persuaded the Chinese government and the authorities to give him the wherewithal to make this journey. So much of the book, material that I'm not reading, the more academic kind of discussion of Chinese seamanship and navigational techniques and so on, I'll leave you to discover. I'm just giving you some of the more humorous narratives from the book. At one point, I made two trips to China. I came back halfway because my youngest daughter was being married and I had to organize that. And I needed to teach and make a little money to. I'd spent my advance for the book and had no more money to carry on, so I had to come back and make some money. And I went, headed again to China, and took a trip up the Yangtze to the ancient city of Jingzhou, where Hui Hsien returned to tell his story after his 41 years away from China. And I looked around Jingzhou for a translator, found a translator, a wonderful woman, and her father was a historian. And I mentioned Hui Hsien and thought, well, I'd be taken down to the grave and shown the grave. She says, who? She phoned her father. Who is Hui Hsien? Have you ever heard of a monk that's traveled to the Americas? No, nobody had heard of Hui Hsien in Jingzhou. I went to the monastery. And the monastery had one of the only three copies in China of the classical Book of the Monks, History of the Monks. And I had seen a small excerpt from this volume translated into English in North America here, which referred to Hui Hsien directly, because when he came back, he was given the job as head of the Northern Missions in China. And he did that until 518 when he died, and then his body was taken back to Jingzhou for burial. So it was very interesting. So I hit a dead end at that point, and I continued on to my journey, went back to Hong Kong, and got on board a container ship. Although I was convinced that the Asian shipbuilders were excellent and that the Chinese had made many journeys, there was no way I was going to take a junk back. I'm a sailor. I've written a little book called Sailing Home, and I'm a very indifferent sailor. Stephen Hume, the journalist in the Vancouver Sun, went out with me on my first day on board my small sloop before I was setting off on this 1,000-mile journey. And we were sailing from Victoria to Bellingham, where I had a teaching job for a couple of years, and it was raining. We were between Salt Spring and between Saturna and San Juan Island. There was a lot of chop. It was raining like hell. Steve was at the tiller. I was trying to look at the charts to keep the rain, with this plastic sheet to keep the rain off, and I looked up at Steve and I said, "Steve, what are these asterisks?" And his eyes grew large and disbelieving. I thought he was going to leap overboard and swim to Saturna. He said, "Gary, those asterisks are rocks." So I knew I would have to have a chapter in my book on the encounters with the deadly how to avoid the deadly asterisk. So there was no way I was going to sail my little boat or anyone else's little boat back from China. So I took a container ship and set off from Hong Kong. We went to Kaohsiung in Taiwan, then to Busan in Korea, and then through the Sugoro-Keiko, between Honshu and Hokkaido, in the two islands, main islands of Japan. and then the North Circle route to Seattle and Vancouver. And this was a little moment where we stopped in Korea. Pusan had grown haphazardly in response to the dictates of war and trade. I'd spent the previous evening drinking beer at a small bar on the infamous Texas Street, once a dangerous red light district, but now a rather benign tourist area where merchants... Shall I start that paragraph again? I'd spent the previous evening drinking beer at a small bar on the infamous Texas Street, once a dangerous red light district, but now a rather benign tourist area where merchants are more active than sex trade workers in plying their wares. Udo was a young German psychiatric nurse who I'd met in Hong Kong when I got on board the ship. He had taken this container ship thinking he'd have wonderful travels. And in the old days on freighters, you often did, because the freighter would spend a week or two in a port and you could have a good look around. Nowadays, they're so careful about the timing that you can be in and out of there in several hours with all those containers removed and loaded. And Udo got to Hong Kong and he'd had hardly any time off the ship, and he was looking forward to a couple of days in Hong Kong. The message came from the captain that they were going to be there for 5 hours. So, and I got on board, he was almost weeping. He spent all of his time up on the bow watching albatrosses and very... I think he thought the ship was an albatross. Anyway, here were Udo and I. So Udo and I decided to tag along with the Russian and Tuvalu's crew members who were itching to take advantage of an all-too-brief shore leave. Igor Falev, the cook, known as Galis, decked out in a black leather vest, checkered bandana, earring, and dark beard, looked quite fierce. I was glad to have him on my side. Suzlanov, the second mate, was heavy set and sported two gold teeth that I imagined to be connected with a fight. I did not know what to expect from these pirates of Po Hong, that's the name of the ship, brawls, blatant whoring, you name it, but I was hoping they would not get me into any trouble. First stop, the money changers, where an American dollar could be exchanged for approximately 1,000 Korean won. Galis shouted to a woman and disappeared with her into a doorway some distance down the street. I was surprised, since he'd only changed a paltry $10. Even then, I could hear his voice dickering over the price in English. I should have turned around, but my curiosity got the better of me. I slunk down the street and peeked around the doorway, fully expecting to see some sort of erotic quick fix. Galis was speaking loudly and waving some sort of implement in the air. Light reflected off its sharp edges. Oh my God, I thought, a knife. But he was dickering with the woman over the price of her carrot peelers. Eventually, the cook emerged into the street with a huge smile and a new carrot peeler and garlic crusher, which he'd purchased for $1 apiece. He dropped his prizes into my Duthie's book bag for safekeeping, then disappeared again to phone his girlfriend in Russia. The area we walked through should have been called Little Russia rather than Texas Street, since most of the women and many of the merchants were either Russian or spoke the language fluently. Fish and vegetable stalls were closing down, but buckets of water still boiled with live eels. Suslanov and Galis commandeered a table in the middle of the street and ordered beer.
Only Chekhovs stand next to Shakespeare.
The cook did not share my enthusiasm for Dostoevsky and Yevtushenko. As light faded from the sky over Pusan, giving Texas Street an unearned intimacy, the conversation shifted to Russian politics. Galis wondered who was responsible for installing Putin in the Kremlin. Suzlanov raised his hand like the Pope, index finger pointing skyward.
I confess, it was me.
He confided, taking a small Mickey of vodka and 4 ceramic shot glasses out of his rucksack.
This top secret, I KGB agent, don't tell nobody.
His remark was all the funnier since the hostess of this sidewalk bar refused to believe he was Russian and kept insisting he was Dutch or Polish. We offered a silent toast to his secret mission, another to his disguised nationality. Eventually, I'd had enough beer and vodka to tell them Igor Bolshakov's anecdote about the prostitute in the Canary Islands who could not understand her client's sexual ineptitude. "Are you impotent?" she asked, stroking his knee. "No." "Are you gay?" Her hand moved up his thigh. "No." She stood up, grabbed her clothes from the bedside table. At the door, she turned and spat. "So, you're Russian." I think that's probably a good spot just to end on. When I came back, when I landed with that from that ship in Vancouver, I went on down to Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, looking for what I thought would be signs of pre-Columbian Asian contact. The day before I left Vancouver, I had two emails from Mexican poets, Homero Arrigues and his wife Betty emailed me to say that an article had appeared in the pages of the Reforma newspaper the day before to the effect that on level 5 of the temple of the moon at Teotihuacan, two archaeologists had discovered some sacrificial figures, Saburo Sugiyama and a Mexican archaeologist whose name just suddenly vanished from my head, had made these discoveries. They'd found a way into the Temple of the Moon, and it was quite a remarkable discovery. They found some non-voluntary sacrificial figures with their hands and feet tied, but then they found these three figures sitting in full lotus posture, with a little figure beside them sitting in the same lotus posture, which, you know, when you're going off looking for information about possible Buddhist travelers to Asia, you think, Huishen's partners, there they are. The other was a wonderful sort of propitious moment because it sort of shaped what I was looking for, part of what I was looking for in Mexico when I went. The other email was from Gabriel Zaid, a Palestinian Mexican, who said, 30 years ago, Gary, I was down in Oaxaca, and I went to a little museum south of Oaxaca at Mitla, and I saw a figure there that was totally uncharacteristic of Mexican art. It was All I can say is that it was flor de loto invertido. It was inverted lotus posture. And he said it's got to have a Asian origin. And well, I don't know if you know, you get into a lotus posture and then somehow you flip yourself up until you're still in the lotus posture and you're standing on your head. It's tricky. It was, although the Maya knew how to do the lotus posture and were quite commonly depicted in lotus posture, there was no evidence that any of them ever tried the inverted lotus posture, as far as I know. Maybe that's how the Maya disappeared. They kept trying the inverted lotus posture. So I set off to Mexico and to see some of the major sites, and I talked to a lot of people. My travels eventually brought me back home because I'd been up to Haida Gwaii a year before I started all of this travel. And it was December. I was going to do a poetry reading in Haida Gwaii. And I thought, well, I'll go to see the totem poles at Skidigat. I know they're carving new poles for a ceremony at Skidigat. I went to the museum and it was pitch black. It was just a huge lake of water in front of the museum. And I drove through this and got out and splashed through the water, went up to the museum door. And as I passed, I could see these five
tarpaulins, plastic tarpaulins, and they were all covering these totem poles that were being constructed, and one of them was lit up, and there was rock music coming out of it, and there were Christmas tree lights on it. I dearly wanted to look in there, but I didn't want to disturb some sort of Haida Michelangelo at work. And so I crept up to the museum and looked in, and it was pitch black. There was nothing happening, but there was a picture of me on the door announcing the poetry reading, or some sort of artifact perhaps they were advertising. Anyway, I went back down, and I was about to pass this tent, and the flap opened, gave birth to this figure and head, and started beckoning to me, and I went over, and I was ushered into this tarpaulin. And it wasn't Michelangelo, it was Michael Nicol Yagulinas, a Haida carver and cartoonist, who was working on one of the poles, and he was playing some music. I said, what is it, Jefferson Airplane? He said, no, The Doors. And there was a pile of tapes on top of this totem pole, and we just had this wonderful discussion. Michael met me the next day for lunch, and I told him about my quest. I said, I'm up here to do a reading ostensibly, but I'm really here because I'm interested in Haida Gwaii as a likely stopping place for Asian travelers. And he got this funny little expression on his face, and he said, we have a story about Asian travelers. There's a story that comes down from my family that Asian monks were here in the distant past and helped to build stone cairns over the mountains from the Pacific into Masset Inlet. And I said, come on, Michael, I know. If I'd told you I was here looking for Vikings, I'm sure you'd have had a story about that. He said, well, you don't need to believe me. He said, but it was one of my relatives, and one of them was even had your last name, Geddes. And I said, now I know you're bullshitting me. And he said, there was a small film made about it by the Language Learning Institute, or Open University in Vancouver. And so there was, and so began another renewed interest in another little possibility. So I had... The last part of the book is my trip to Haida Gwaii with Martin Duckworth from Montreal, a filmmaker, looking for the cairns on Haida Gwaii. So we made a trip into the mountains, and I'll just leave you with that as a speculative moment to think about. So any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer, other than really technical, archaeological ones that are going to embarrass me.
By the way, the most recent books are available in the lobby, and there will be refreshments served tonight, so do stop in on your way past. And now we're ready for questions. Please make them brief and to the point. Yes.
What are your lines of evidence for the Asian region, North America?
What are my
lines of evidence?
Lines of evidence. You almost have to read the book. I don't think I could sum them up. I've done quite a bit of reading about a variety of different elements, including bark beating techniques, paper making techniques, the early Asian melanotic chickens that were here when the Spanish arrived. David Kelly at the University of Calgary, a very respected archaeologist, is absolutely convinced that the Mayan calendar owes a good deal to the Indo-European calendar, and that he's convinced that the Maya were taken back, or that there was some exchange. Calendar was perhaps brought over. He says that the Maya, in fact, improved on the original calendar. It's much more accurate. So there were a number of things like that along the way that gave me some interesting additional sort of quasi-evidence, I suppose. It's still quite impressionistic. We don't have a Lanzo Meadows site with a Chinese equivalent to the Viking burial ship. But things are beginning to show up, like those Asian shipbuilding tools and earlier sites which suggest the possibility of human settlement long before Clovis and long before the 15,000 years that we've generally thought people came in. The Bering Land Bridge is beginning to look about as recent a form of crossing as the English Channel is in getting from France to England. It seems as if the Bering Land Bridge theory, which was accepted absolutely with almost no evidence whatsoever, is on the way out. It may still have been a source of some travel across, but it doesn't appear anymore to most people, I think, or at least a group of people, to have been the only and major source of peopling of the Americas. Yes?
Did you ever get to see the Inverted Lotus?
No, it was one of the... did I get to see the Inverted Lotus posture? The only lotus posture I saw was a couple of young Canadians trying it on top of the temple at the Tikal to show me what a lotus posture was. When I got to Mitla, the museum was closed. I did a lot of exploration around amongst academics and scholars and found that all the material had been shipped into Oaxaca to the museum there. It was in boxes. They would not open it. I was given promises that somebody would go and check it out for me. I offered to pay salary to have them do that, but it never happened. So I may not see that until I go back to Mitla and find the museum renovated and restored and back in place. Yes? The question about the book of Buddhist monks, it was in Chinese, of course, and I, with translator, was trying to explain to the monk who was searching through the book what I was looking for. He found many names quite similar to it, but he didn't find the Huixian name. But I know it exists because I've seen it, seen the translations in other sources. It was just one of those many moments in a foreign place where I didn't have the time and the technical expertise in the language to actually do the research myself. Yes?
We've heard the poetry in your book. Is it all poetry, or is there some actual prose where you actually discuss history, or is the whole book poetry?
No, there is quite a bit of that. It's not the best writing in the book, so I'm going to leave that up to you to have a look at and judge on your own. I didn't come here to convince you one way or the other. I did come here to entertain you and to help raise a few questions. Yes?
Did you find any evidence that the Chinese had the capability of making that journey by vessel?
The Chinese junk has been around for 2,500 to 3,000 years, and the junk has changed almost nothing in those 3,000 years. It's infinitely better than the square-rigged ship that the Europeans used, and it was only after discovering what the Arabs and the Chinese and others were using, the use they were making of the lug sails, that the Europeans began to change their sailing techniques. The Chinese, in other words, could have sailed in those vessels 3,000 years ago. And it seems to me one thing, there are many details that I can't go into it at the moment, but one thing that interests me is the fact that even 15,000 years ago during the glacial maximus, we know now that there were areas of Haida Gwaii and Alaska that were not covered with ice, that were supported life. Remains have been found in caves to indicate that. We also know that the sea levels were 50 to hundreds of feet lower, and it meant that it would be far less daunting in that period, even in that period, to have come by way of coastal migration with small boats, because you'd never be, since the sea level was so much lower, you'd never be more than 50 miles away from the next landfall, so that it would have been a good deal simpler making those kinds of journeys. And of course, a sea journey has, there's food available constantly. These were fishing people. They knew how to handle boats and how to fish. The shoreline, such as might have been available then and earlier, had fish as well. So it seems not difficult for me to believe that the sea and the coastal migration was a major source of the peopling of the Americas, rather than people chasing woolly mammoths down a possibly non-existent ice-free corridor. And would anything have grown in that ice-free corridor if it did indeed exist the way we think it might have existed? People have, as someone has suggested, Paul Tolstoy at the University Université de Montréal has said that we all suffer from thalassophobia. Most people do. That's fear of the sea. But David Kelly and Betty Meggers and others have suggested that the sea is not a barrier, was not a barrier to ancient people. It was more like a superhighway or a conveyor belt. And I'm convinced that they're right on that score, and that it's just a matter of time when we begin to find some of these some more evidence. The Chinese are always already finding rudder posts that are 40 feet long. Can you imagine the size of a boat that takes a 40-foot long rudder post? Hundreds of feet long, and with seven masts, and you know, yes. Yes, I was asked before the talk about Gavin Menzies and his book 1421. I had a chance to interview him in Washington, D.C., and I reviewed his book for the Globe and Mail. It's a fascinating thesis, which is by no means proven yet. It's highly speculative, and a lot of the details that he offers as proof for his theory really are proof for earlier repeated contact, not for the 1421, because most of the information he's chosen was provided by Meggers and other people decades ago to suggest that Asian contact had taken place. But it's an interesting thesis, and we know that the information about boats from Louise Levath's book, When China Ruled the Seas, an earlier book, is accurate. And there's lots of proof from the Chinese records that those ships went to Africa and they went to India. There's no proof yet, indisputable proof, that they got beyond that. Lots of speculation. Yes? Oh, I'm going to dwindle into poetry again for a while. I think it was, as I said, I tread where angels and scholars feared to tread, and I think my skills as a scholar were taxed to the limit here. I'm going to get back to writing some poetry at the moment, and I'm working, in fact, on a book about the collapse of the Second Narrows Bridge in Vancouver. That's why it's wonderful, one of the reasons it's wonderful for me to be back at Green College, back to my alma mater at UBC, because I'm interviewing veterans and engineers and people who survived the bridge disaster and families of those who did not survive. And the bridge went down during construction June 17, 1958, 2 weeks after I graduated from high school in Vancouver at King Edward High School. My father was a deep sea diver. He was called out to look for bodies in the wreckage of the Second Narrows Bridge. And I've never ever been able to shake the image of my father hanging from a lifeline, an umbilical cord of oxygen in that swirling water and twisted metal under the Second Narrows Bridge. So that's my next project, and so I'll be here for a while doing that.
And you're liable to be giving us a report on it when you get it all settled.
If you dare to invite me back, I'll be happy to do that. Thank you.
I'm now going to call on Dr. Bert Alsop to express our thanks to our speaker.
Mr. Chairman, members and friends of the Vancouver Institute, what a thrilling and inspiring presentation we've had from Professor Geddes in our 90th year of the Vancouver Institute. I think that I should express a few points of view as someone who comes from the Caribbean, and where we have had lots of Asian, more latter-day Asian Marco Polos who have resided in the Caribbean, and we've had the head of state, the first head of state in Guyana was President Arthur Chung, and the first Governor General of Trinidad was Sir Solomon Ho Choi, both of whom derived from China. So we've had latter-day Asian Marco Polos. This has been a very fascinating thing for me, because as I traveled myself to Asian countries, particularly China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Vietnam, and Thailand, all the cultural attributes of those countries were very somewhat familiar because of the Chinese settlements in the Caribbean, but also indicative of a new type of arrangement which we have now seen blossoming out in Western Canada, here in Vancouver and British Columbia. I think that Professor Geddes has given us an insight into some of the aspects in his book and in other publications, and his poetry and his style that have been quite stimulating. As a matter of fact, we have been somewhat titillated to buy his book and to look forward to the one that is to be written on the Second Narrows. And since I reside in Deep Cove, I think that's going to be a somewhat stimulating for me too. I feel there could easily have been another dozen questions from the audience, and I think that your presence here tonight, despite the inclement weather, attests to not only the reputation of Professor Geddes, but also to the attraction of the subject. I would ask you then to join me in expressing your appreciation of his presentation in the customary fashion.